Welcome. Inside Appalachia, I'm Jessica Lilly. I'm sure you're well aware of the heated debate that's sweeping across the South about the Confederate battle or rebel flag. The conversation and outrage was sparked after 9 people were shot and killed inside a historic African-American church in Charleston, South Carolina. A 21-year-old white man confessed to killing 6 women and 3 men. Here's West Virginia University Vice President David Friesen speaking about the violent incident.
Well, you know, the church is called within the community. It's not just Emmanuel AME Church. It's Mother Emmanuel. And the reason it's called Mother Emmanuel, it's kind of the heart of the freedom movement. It just has a rich history of always being in the forefront of our social change. And for this to occur at this church at this time, this was not by accident. The people who are trying to act like this is some kind of wide-eyed, crazy person need to understand that there was a lot of intentionality here.
That was David Friesen, a pastor, a lawyer, and a leader of West Virginia University's Division of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. We'll hear more from Friesen in a little bit. After the violent shooting, photos surfaced that showed the confessed shooter, Dylan Roof, posing with weapons and a Confederate battle flag. The incident spurred a debate to remove the flag from public buildings in South Carolina. South Carolina's Governor Nikki Haley, a Republican, has called for the Confederate battle flag to be removed from the state capitol grounds. She said that while she understood that for many South Carolinians, the flag represents respect for the memory of those who fought for the South during the Civil War, for others, the flag has come to represent hate. And now, the Ku Klux Klan is holding a protest against South Carolina's removal of the Confederate battle flag. Also, at least 7 black churches have burned across the South in wake of the shootings. At this time, it isn't clear yet how many of these fires were caused by arson. So clearly, this issue is still heating up across the South, and we wanted to check in with many of you to find out how Appalachians are dealing with these events. Our producer, Roxy Todd, was passing through Randolph County, West Virginia last weekend, across the road from the historically black school in Elkins called Riverside School. There, Roxy caught up with 3 generations of an African-American family to talk to them about their thoughts on the Confederate battle flag.
Margaret Marks grew up hearing her parents tell her stories about segregation and the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 1960s. Her parents also taught her the history of how the Confederate flag was used at the beginning of the century when Jim Crow laws began throughout the South persecuting blacks. I asked Margaret, what does she think of the Confederate battle flag when she sees it used?
I don't necessarily say that somebody has it on their car or their house that I have an objection to that per se, because people have a right to express their beliefs. The Confederate flag is part of our history and the history of the United States. And there was, you know, it was a battle flag for the South during the Civil War. What I have objection to is the symbol that the Confederate flag has been used for. You see like hate groups and, you know, Ku Klux Klan and Aryan Nation, and they use that Confederate flag to promote their beliefs. And I think that is where the Confederate flag has become a negative symbol. And so in that respect, I think that it also is a symbol of a division in this country.
Though Margaret was born into a world where these hate groups are less numerous, she says she is concerned that blacks and whites in our country still have a lot of work to do to overcome racism.
I guess I believe that it's a good thing to take the flag down off of state buildings and federal buildings and that sort of thing. I'm not going to say that I can go and say to, you know, somebody who has a, you know, picture of the Confederate flag that no, you can't hang that in your window of your home, or you can't have that posted in your home, because that's, you know, it has some kind of symbolic meaning to them. Do I believe that the Confederate flag should be remembered? Absolutely, because it is a part of our history, and a part of our past. And if anything that the past week, week and a half has shown me is that my parents used to say all the time, if you don't remember your history, you are doomed to repeat your history. And when that shooting in that church occurred, I automatically thought, what decade am I living in? Mm-hmm. Because, and that's just kind of, you know, what it is. I think that we need to remember that. And we need to remember, you know, just looking at the past year with race relations in this country, it just seems like, I don't know if it's just more in the forefront, if there's more broadcasting about it, or what it is, but I think that we need to take heed to what is going on and coming together. And the thing that I liked about South Carolina when all of this happened is that that city unified together. That young boy, he went into that church, stated he wanted to cause a race war. He did the exact opposite. Those people came together, they unified, black, white, whatever color, whatever religion, it didn't matter. They were unified together and in support of that church and the congregation in that church. And I think that that's what really a wonderful thing and what needs to be focused on.
Margaret's father, Melvin Marks, says he does remember an incident in Elkins over the Confederate battle flag. One year, during a forest festival, a fire truck from Beverly came to Elkins bearing the Confederate flag across the front of the truck.
And that was offensive to me as far as I was concerned, because I think my taxes have helped support the fire department. And so we went to the county commission, and since that time there has not been an American flag on the fire trucks yet, since that time. Because as a black man, I know that the Civil War was there was a fight to sort of keep me in bondage, so to speak, there. But also a fight to free me from bondage.
One of Melvin's granddaughters, 15-year-old Mazella Marks, says some of her friends have a Confederate flag tattooed on their arm, and she doesn't have an issue with that.
So I think it should be people's rights to have the Confederate flag hanging in their cars and their windows, anywhere. They can have a tattoo showing off in the public. It wasn't racism until, like, the Ku Klux Klan or whatever came around.
Mazella's grandparents have taught her a lot of the history from the civil rights struggles. But she admits that she feels pretty far removed from that history and from that level of racism that her grandfather faced.
The generation he grew up in, I never really understand why they had to separate the whites from the colored, or... like, they separated everything. They separated the waters, they separated the bathrooms, the restaurants, the buses. To be honest, I think the buses was the one I never got, because a seat's a seat. It shouldn't matter if you're black or white and you have to sit down. Like, Rosa Parks sat in the whites because she was tired and from working all day. If I was her, I would have put up a fight and not go... probably would have been in jail faster, but still.
She went to jail anyways, honey.
Pulling Madea moves, just be like, I ain't going.
I just played
but still, he's been through it. My grandmother's been through it. Their parents been through it.
They don't know yet.
I do.
She knows some.
That's Mazella's grandmother, Kay. She says that though she and Melvin try to teach their grandchildren about the history of oppression that black people have faced over the years in America, it is difficult for Mazella's generation to fully understand that history. While I sat on the porch with the Marks family, talking about the Confederate battle flag, it began to rain. The children who had been playing outside, both black and white, came up off the street and sat and listened to the conversation. Randall Marks was one of the youngest. Here's his hope for the future.
I want peace, and I really want to fly.
If you didn't catch that, Randall said, I want peace, and I really want to fly. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Roxy Todd in Elkins.
Gonna lay down my burden down by the riverside, down by the riverside, down by the riverside. Gonna lay down my burden down by the riverside. Steady, warm. No, well, I ain't.
You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Now, when I was growing up in Wyoming County, West Virginia, I proudly wore the uniform to cheer for my team, the Mullins Rebels. Our mascot was a little guy with a funny hat wearing a gray uniform. I never really thought about the historical affiliation of the soldier, but rather its connection to my school. Students would paint the Confederate flags on their cheeks during big games. But I didn't think a lot about it. There weren't many African Americans in my school. At one time, there was only one in my class. Her name is Angela Asbury, formerly Angela Christian. And I caught up with her earlier this week to find out how she felt about the Confederate battle or rebel flag and attending a school with rebel as a mascot.
But it didn't really bother me too much. I didn't think much about it. But where when it really hit home and it had me start thinking about it is when, you know, I played basketball for Mullins, the Rebels, Rebelettes. And we was in high school. We went to a game. I believe it was in Welch. And I went outside to go get my headphones out of off the bus. And, you know, a few of the black kids there approached me about it. And, you know, they were teasing me and saying, how could you play ball for a school like that, waving that flag, and it's representing racism and, you know, a bunch of stuff like that. And it didn't click until then. It didn't bother me that they were saying it. It just, you know, it confused me because I never really thought too much about it. And, you know, as I got older, I educated myself about it, and I learned, you know, more about it. And even after learning what I do know now about it, being a Confederate flag representing, you know, the South wanting to keep slavery and its history and stuff. And even today, people up here wave it. You see it everywhere. And although I guess West Virginia wasn't a Confederate state, but it is what it is. You hear people saying family members was in the war, so that's why it's up here. But again, it don't bother me. Never really did, even after learning the history and educating myself. And do I think it's considered racist? No, not really. Not right off the bat. You know, because honestly, that's part of history. That's what happened. Now, you do have some people up here, they wave it, and they're waving it because they're racist. But it don't bother me, because I've grown up, I've educated myself, and people are going to think, do, and say what they want regardless of how I feel about it.
Do you think that some people in this community wave it because it's a part of school pride? Like school pride and not necessarily racism or even the Confederacy or history or heritage, but rather just school pride?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I believe that. I think some people actually do. That's, you know, people take pride in where they go to school and what they do, especially if they play sports. I did. You know, I wasn't up here waving it around or nothing, but, you know, I took pride because I played sports. I was an athlete. That's what I did. I represented my school, and I tried to be good at what I did and represent my school to the best. So, yeah, definitely.
Did it make you, going back to when the folks at Welch were sort of poking fun at you and giving you a hard time for it, did it make you think differently of your identity or the people that you were playing with on the team because of another community's perspective on the flag?
Sure. For a little bit, yeah, it did. You know, at first it hurt a little bit, and I felt like, you know, it's not right. You know what I'm saying? I felt like, well, they're right. You know, what am I doing? You know, I'm being a black person up here running around, you know, other people waving this flag that's considered to be racist. But after thinking about it, I actually sat down and talked to my mother about it, and she said, baby girl, again, you don't need to worry about what other people think or say. You do what you want to do.
Do you still take pride in saying that you were a Mullins Rebel?
Yeah, I was. That's where I went to school. I grew up, my friends went there. You know, that's part of my life, part of my culture, even as African-American. I grew up in a small white town. I'm not ashamed of that. I loved it. I had fun. My childhood was great. I had fun. I loved it. I didn't have any problems. I mean, a lot of people didn't mess with me. You know, every now and then, you know, you got certain ones that like to poke at you just to try to test you. I ain't gonna lie, I've been called the N-word several times. I got in high school, it didn't bother me, you know.
Are you concerned about your children being back in this community now and growing up in this community?
A little bit, yes. It's there. Anywhere you go, you're going to have issues with race or anything in the matter. It's everywhere. So all I can do is teach my kids right from wrong and have make sure they love themselves for who they are. That's it. Determine my behavior and how I feel about stuff because of their actions and their words.
Do you think it should come down in all places?
I see it causing problems. I don't think it should be taken down everywhere, and I feel it's your freedom, your rights to wave whatever you want and do what you want. But I think as far as little kids, I think it's going to confuse them because not every parent out there is teaching their kids the truth about whatever. And they don't know. And kids are mean. Kids are really mean. I mean, I can't speak for everybody, but like, I just don't see the point of making a controversy. I don't get it. Like I said, people are going to do what they want to do. And as a grown, mature adult, it's up to you to educate yourself, have that mutual respect, and not let others determine your behavior or how you feel, because anywhere you go, flag, Confederate flag, battle flag, KK flag, it don't matter. People are going to do what they want, say what they want, regardless of how you feel about it.
I think that's a good place to stop. Thank you, Angela.
You're welcome, girlfriend.
That was Angela Asbury, who spent her entire childhood in Mullins, West Virginia. I also spoke with another classmate and fellow cheerleader, Nina Tunstall. She moved to town when she was in the fifth grade. Before that, she attended an all-black private school in California.
It was a culture shock because we were the only two African-Americans in our entire grade. There was one other boy. He was mixed with white and black.
Nina says she never wanted to be called a rebel, but athletics were an important part of the community, so she joined the cheerleading team.
I cheered for the Rebels, and I was the loudest cheerleader out there, and, you know, I took pride in my school, but it was just unfortunate that I was subject to that. You know, I don't agree with what the rebel and what the Confederate flag stands for. But it's just unfortunate that it, in order to participate, that is what I had to do.
But the toughest part for Nina wasn't being called a Confederate rebel or seeing the Confederate battle flag.
It's kind of weird because just being like the only little black girl in a big old school, like I didn't really, you know, we had our little crushes, but it was kind of like you knew that nothing would come out of it. Like I knew in high school that I would probably never have a boyfriend. Like, and if somebody liked me, they probably couldn't, you know, express that openly. And the girls that did express their interest in my brother openly, they were put down, they were talked about, they were, you know, they had some negative backlash. So it definitely was there. It wasn't as out in the open, but it did increase even after the Rebels was gone.
So on one hand, she faced some unique limitations at my school because she was black. Still, I had always considered her to be one of the popular kids, and so did many of my friends. Today, Tunstall still lives in Wyoming County and teaches Spanish to 7th and 8th graders across the county. And like the rest of the country, things have changed, are changing.
You know, my students, they're different. You know, I think the younger generations come, they're more open. I'm probably one of their favorite teachers. I know I am. Like, I'm just awesome. But my kids love me. They totally love me. And I'm one of their favorites, and we love each other, and they're open with me. They tell me about their lives, and they're interested in the black culture. Like, when I come in, one of the major things about my classroom is even my hairstyles. Like, one day I might have long, straight hair all the way down my back. The next day I might come in with a curly afro. And so just they're just so intrigued by a different culture, and they're like, how do you do that? What is that? You know, and so we have a lot of commonalities. Like, they listen to rap music, and they're surprised that I know all the lyrics, and I'm surprised that they know some of them, too.
And as for the Confederate battle flag?
It is a part of history that can't be denied, but that's exactly what it is. It's history. Put it in a museum, put it in a book, put it in a case, but it shouldn't be flying. It shouldn't be flying at institutions, public institutions, where little black kids and little white kids have to walk underneath it. You know, it just doesn't have a place in today's society. They lost. We don't fly flags of the losers. We fly the flags of the winners.
As I got older and grasped the pain of my friends and African Americans across the country, I decided it just didn't seem worth it to wave the Confederate battle flag. But I'll never be ashamed to say that I'm a Mullins rebel and still consider myself to be one. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Next, for some help understanding how the violent, admittedly racist mass murders in South Carolina could lead to a new conversation about diversity here in the Mountain State, we're going to hear from David Friesen. Friesen is a pastor, a lawyer, and leads WVU's Division of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. He recently spoke on a podcast from West Virginia Public Broadcasting called The Front Porch. Executive Director Scott Finn is joined on this episode by Laurie Lynn, columnist for the Charleston Daily Mail, and they ask Friesen, what's the next step after this brutal slaying of 9 innocent churchgoers?
It takes a tragic event like this, and I truly believe that this is really an homage to what I consider to be the martyrdom of these 9, and I cannot think of a more appropriate act for their death to mean that, yes, we are having this conversation that comes out of the ashes of this despicable act, especially when you look at the history of the flag, because we have to put the history of the flag within its context. After the Civil War, Robert E. Lee said, put the flags away. And so the flags were put away. The flags weren't put back out again in terms of any kind of heritage until the 1890s. And it was in the 1890s when there was a push for black suffrage that suddenly this Civil War flag comes out again. It was put away again then until the 1950s when integration came. And so when you look at the flag that flies over the Capitol in South Carolina, that wasn't resurrected until 1962. So it really doesn't have the kind of link to heritage. It's the link to the heritage of slavery and discrimination and marginalization that people of color have had to face in the South.
That was David Friesen, West Virginia University's vice president. Friesen is a pastor, lawyer, and leads WVU's Division of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. He was talking with Scott Finn of West Virginia Public Broadcasting and Laurie Lynn, columnist for the Charleston Daily Mail. To hear more of this podcast called The Front Porch, head over to our website, wvpublic.org. It's time for What's in a Name, a segment on Inside Appalachia that explores the history and folklore of the names of Appalachian places. This song you're hearing, of course, is Dixie, which was used as the Confederate battle tune during the Civil War. But where does the name Dixie come from? Where exactly is this place called Dixie, and what's the history behind the word? We'll have the answer after the break. You're listening to Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly with the answer to this week's What's in a Name quest. This week we're exploring Dixie, which is commonly used to reference the South. I caught up with historian Dr. Jonathan Berkey from Concord University to find out more.
Well, it's actually pretty obscure. We're not entirely sure where exactly it came from. There are a couple stories about where it came from. One is Louisiana before the Civil War. There was a bank in Louisiana that had a $10 note that they called a Dix note, D-I-X. And so some people think that that's where the association came from. Most people, however, believe that it came from the Mason-Dixon line that separates Pennsylvania and Maryland. That was established in 1767, and it really kind of delineates slave territory from free territory in the United States, the slave states from the free states. And so most people associate it with that Mason-Dixon line. However, we are sure about its association with the Confederacy. In the spring of 1859, a New York songwriter wrote the song Dixie for a minstrel show in the North. It actually came south in the late 1860, and so about the same time that states were leaving the Union and forming the Confederacy, they were becoming aware of the song Dixie. And Jefferson Davis, actually, the president of the Confederacy, had it played at his inauguration. And so this Northern song has been kind of adopted by the South during the Civil War, and it's been associated with the South ever since. it's simple but complicated. And so I think just like other symbols of the South, it's interpreted in different ways and different people view it in different ways.
I wish I was in the land of cotton, old times done and done.
But lots of people enjoy the song. Abraham Lincoln loved the song. You know, when the war was over, he always liked to play Dixie and kind of suggest it was an American song and not just a Southern song. And so I think, just like anything else with our past, it's kind of this, I don't know, competition over, is it a Southern song, is it an American song? Can something be Southern and American? I believe so, but, you know, not everybody, you know, agrees with that interpretation.
If you have another story about Dixie or know of another place in Appalachia with an interesting sound or mysterious folklore behind it, send us a tweet at InAppalachia, hashtag What's in a Name, and we might explore it inside Appalachia. Next up, we'd like to share part of the latest episode of West Virginia Public Broadcasting's podcast, Us and Them. The podcast explores issues of cultural friction and conflict in America. His podcast often features a woman named Alice Moore, who has very strong views on religion and often fights for conservative values. Here's host Trey Kay and his friend Alice Moore visiting a Civil War gravesite in Mississippi.
So where are we right now?
Well, we're in the oldest cemetery in Corinth, and where several Confederate soldiers are buried. It started, 1842, is that what it was?
Let's go read the sign again, because okay. I don't have that. I'm sorry. That's me with my friend Alice Moore. She lives in Tennessee near the Mississippi border. I went to visit her last winter, and one day we drove down to Corinth, Mississippi. She wanted to show me their city cemetery.
City cemetery. Earliest evidence of Corinth's settlement, oldest cemetery in the city, with the first burial dated at 1842.
So describe to me what we're seeing here in the cemetery.
Well, you come in the gate here, there you see a Confederate flag right there, and they're scattered all over the cemetery.
Is there a time of year where they put up the flags?
Or? Not that I know of. When I've been out here, I know I counted 17 one time. It's an old cemetery, so you expect that, you know, you've got Confederate soldiers out here.
What do you feel like when you see the flag here in the cemetery?
I love the flag. I love what it represents. I love the fact that it was the flag of people who stood up and fought for what ended up being a losing cause, but they believed in what they were doing. They knew they were in a minority, but they fought a tremendous battle. That flag represents standing up for what's right and just and fighting for what you believe in.
Do you understand that the Confederate battle flag, to many people in this country, that it's a symbol that is akin to the swastika? And that it's very difficult for them to see it any other way.
Well, are you concerned, or does it bother you that there are people in this country who see that flag as representing their ancestors and a war that was fought against unbelievable odds and fought so bravely and gallantly, and people suffered horribly in the South? And I don't think the United States has ever treated a country like the South was treated after the war. People literally were starving to death in the South. And that flag represents their grandfathers and their great-grandfathers and memories of their families. I had a friend visiting down one time who said to me, I just don't understand why people want to keep fighting that war, the Civil War, over and over. Why they still feel so strongly about that war? Well, it's because we were invaded. Our country was invaded, and our country was destroyed.
That was an excerpt from the latest episode of Us and Them. It's called In Dixieland, I'll Take My Stand, and it was recently recognized by The Timber, a podcast review site, as one of the best podcasts in the country last week. Here's another clip from this episode, a scene between Alice Moore and Trey Kay.
And yep. we have records of people and their families being separated. We have
I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about what happened in the majority of cases. And someone made the point, if you had a $5,000 horse, you wouldn't abuse that horse. You'd feed him well and take good care of him, and you'd want him to be in great shape. You would treat him with kindness. And if you had a $5,000 slave, you didn't want to abuse and mistreat that man. He was a much better slave if he was a happy man.
So I wanted to hear more about this conversation and why Trey Kay decided to talk to Alice and challenge her on this issue. I caught up with Trey this week to find out more about the podcast and this particular show. Trey Kay is a native of Charleston, West Virginia, but he now lives in New York. Now, in the clip that we just heard, Alice shares some strong views, and you seem somewhat aggressive as you speak to her on this issue. Later in the podcast, you go on to say that you think Alice is a good person, but what did you learn by talking with her?
Well, I do think Alice is a good person, and I think that she's flawed just like all of us. You know, she's got her good points and she's got her bad points. But the thing is, I want to hear her perspective on the world. And in particular, I want to know why she has such deep love for the Old South, and why it is that she seems to want to rely on what seems to me is some pretty tortured defenses of some of the things that are associated with the South. I mean, the slavery and the flag and defenses of Jim Crow and various things that happened during Reconstruction. I want her to, I want to hear about that as opposed to just standing and accusing her of being wrong and thinking that maybe in my accusing finger, pointing at her and speaking to her angrily is all of a sudden going to make her see the light the way I see it. I don't think that's really going to get us anywhere. And I think that we need to understand people like Alice, just like they need to understand us. And that's really kind of what we're trying to foster in us and them is a respectful conversation that's not about shouting or putting people down or ridiculing them or just providing a forum for people on one side of a political or a cultural issue just to vent their frustrations to the other side. I think that we see enough of that with programs on talk radio and on cable news. And I think what we're trying to do with this is to figure out a way how we can get out of the echo chambers, the ideological, like-minded echo chambers that we cluster in, move into the neutral zone and try to figure out how we can have a conversation. And that's what I was trying to do with Alice in that graveyard that day.
And I think that plays into the next clip that I was hoping to play. At one point in the podcast, you ask Cornell University history professor Ed Baptist if he thinks you were wrong for letting someone express an opposing view. Let's listen.
And there are probably going to be people who are going to listen to this podcast who are going to think that I'm wrong for putting someone on who has a view that says that slavery wasn't so bad or that the Confederate flag stands for honor do you think that I'm wrong for letting her articulate that point of view? Is that a point of view that you feel that America needs to hear?
Well, I think you have to bring these ideas out into the light.
And then he goes on to talk about how important it is to have these kinds of conversations. But by asking that question, do you think I'm wrong for articulating that point of view when you said that and you asked the professor that, do you feel that those folks that might have similar feelings as Alice would feel dismissed or irrelevant? Did you think about that or struggle with that as you were producing the podcast?
Well, and I've listened to that clip and I wondered, do you feel that Alice was dismissed or irrelevant? I mean, in the piece, I feel like I gave her a lot of time to make her point. And I mean...
Yes, but then you questioned whether or not you should have done that, and you asked, I think, for legitimacy from the professor. So I just wondered, do you think that in people listening to the podcast might have felt, if they agreed with some points that Alice was making, that they might feel irrelevant?
Well, I hear that, and I confess that even when I listen back to the tape, I think I think I might even have the same reaction that you do. But I think that the people who hear us and them, the people who have been my audience, they come from the NPR listening, sometimes New York Times, Washington Post reading, MSNBC watching audience. They're often blue staters. They're often, you know, liberal people. And they often don't hear a voice like Alice, who is not presented in somewhat of an ironic way. And I think that people have criticized me for presenting Alice sometimes, or people like Alice, without offering context. And that's why I was asking the professor that question, because I've gotten that type of criticism, and I wondered what he thinks of that. What does he think? He's a person who definitely has spoken out about the Deep South and the Confederate flag, and I was wondering to know if he felt that I was giving a microphone to somebody whose voice was not worthy to be heard. I think Alice is worthy to be heard. I think that she represents a good number of I think that she represents a good number of Americans who need to be heard, who need to be understood, even if in listening to them you feel that their logic is flawed. As a professor, John Zimmerman, who appears on several of my podcasts, says, you know, sometimes these people are wrong on many things. Sometimes these people are wrong on several things, but they're not wrong on everything. And just because Alice has points of view that on slavery and how slaves were treated that make me scratch my head, it doesn't mean that I feel that she is to be just discredited and not listened to ever, because she is a good woman. She's a warm woman. She's a good friend of mine. And I can learn from listening to her, as I think many other people can as well.
Because at the end of the day, she's still a human being. And that's often and that's the stance we take here on Inside Appalachia as well. What do you hope people take away from this particular podcast? Why did you do it?
Well, this particular podcast, really, we look at two different icons, that enduring icons from the Civil War era, that still seem to be, that still seem to stir emotions almost as much as they did back, you know, during the time of the war. I mean, you know, the flags, the uniforms, the guns, all that stuff, the tanks, the cannons there in battlefields and memorial monuments and in museums behind glass, and they don't really seem to row emotions. They don't seem to row emotions, but boy, that flag and the song Dixie, I mean, those are things that really still upset people. I mean, the flag we certainly saw after, you know, that horrible murder in South Carolina, and the fact that they are talking about, you know, wanting to pull down the flag from over the Capitol grounds in South Carolina, and that other people are wanting to pull down other Confederate icons throughout the South. I mean, that's really kicked up a stir. And Dixie, I mean, it used to be something that was played, you know, at football games and memorial events and stuff like that. And people in the last decade or so, or a couple decades, have been, you know, just moving that out and saying, no, this is offensive to several people. Well, it clearly is offensive to some people. But then on the other hand, I listened to somebody like Glenn McConnell in the piece, and in my Dixie piece, where he says, this is a part of history. And are we just going to move that off to the dustbin because we feel that it's politically correct? Isn't there a way that we can look maybe at the Confederate flag, the Confederate battle flag, in a song like Dixie, and embrace them and possibly incorporate them and look at them in a new context, and yet not still be set off by the emotions that we feel about them? I'm not exactly sure what the answer to that question is, but I think that it's a question that needs to be asked.
It's a good question for sure. Trey Kay is the host of Us and Them from West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Trey Kay, thanks for being on the show and thanks for your time.
Jessica, thank you so much for including me on Inside Appalachia.
We're going to close with another clip from that podcast where Trey talks with Cornell University history professor Ed Baptist.
I'm related to a lot of people who hold those kinds of views. I grew up around a lot of people like that. I had white teachers who held those kinds of views. I had white teachers who had different kinds of views, and I had African-American teachers who had very different views about the history we were all enmeshed in. And I understand that it's difficult to look back and say, you know, my ancestors were probably part of this. They were on the wrong side of history. It's very difficult because it makes you feel like you are wrong and you are a bad person. But unfortunately, it's just a truth that has to be faced. And let me put it this way. Somebody like Alice is not – I'm not saying she's a bad person, and she's probably better than me, right? But
she's a good person,
I think. But I think she would find a sense of liberation, a sense of freedom if she could let go of the desire to claim against all the evidence that her ancestors were on the right side of history. And the ancestors, I'm not saying that they were bad through and through, although I'm pretty sure that being an enslaver did some pretty horrific things to your soul and to your psyche. But there may still have been people who were not bad through and through who participated in that process. But they did bad things and they participated in a bad system. And there's just no way around that.
What do you think of people like Alice and their expression of love for the Confederate battle flag?
The polls I've seen before the shootings, the polls suggested that over 70% of white South Carolinians supported keeping the flag on the State House grounds. Why is it so important to them? This particular flag was the Confederate battle flag and not the official flag of the Confederacy and so on and so forth, but it's the flag that's become identified with the Confederacy. And the flag was important during the Civil War, but it became important again after, in particular, 1954, Brown versus Board of Education. It started to be used more and more widely as a sort of a rallying emblem for the folks who wanted to defeat what they saw as the rising tide of desegregation and the destruction of Jim Crow and Southern life. Over time, that flag has come to symbolize the resistance of white Southerners to sharing power with African Americans. So there may be formal desegregation, but that doesn't mean that there's actually going to be any rectification of the numerous iniquities that we find in Southern and, you know, American life in general, iniquities that are inflicted on African Americans all the time. It's a symbol of that. When it was being moved from the State House dome to the to its new site on the State House grounds, in fact, supporters of the flag chanted, "Off the dome and in your face, off the dome and in your face." So it's a giant middle finger to African Americans. To people like Alice, it doesn't necessarily mean that, but it does mean a sense of nostalgia for times that seemed perhaps less troubled, where there seemed to be less conflict and less criticism of, for some people like that, their very sense of identity.
You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Thanks for tuning in. You're one of the growing number of fans of Inside Appalachia. Thank you for telling your friends, and thank you for subscribing to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. This year also marks the 50th anniversary of the Appalachian South Folklife Center in Summers County, West Virginia. Its founder, Don West, was a preacher, teacher, union organizer, farmer, and poet. Don was a civil rights activist and educator who left a strong legacy and is said to blaze the trail for many who work for and preach freedom and social justice. Don West was considered one of the most prominent Southern regional poets of the 20th century. In the 1940s, his collection of poetry, Clods of Southern Earth, sold tens of thousands of copies. His wife, Constance Adams West, a native of East Kentucky and talented artist, had her portrait shown in many shows and galleries. She was an art teacher for many years. Here's a piece that helps to paint the picture of how the center started and what it meant to folks.
The Folklife Center was a place where I met like-minded people.
If you need to find a friend to talk to, you probably go by the Folklife Center and find somebody who had a similar experience that you'd had.
We played and sang and danced together, inspired by Pipe Stem and Don and Connie West. So the circle.
Don West started the Appalachian South Folklife Center in 1965 with his wife Connie. He was someone who was fundamentally committed to social change, and he thought one avenue was building cultural pride and strengthening Appalachian identity. Looking back over the last 50 years at the center, I have to say, in its own way, I think his mission has succeeded.
Connie and I started the Folklife Center over at Pipestem. We saved money. One of our salaries we saved for 10 years and lived on the other. And so we had a good little nice little piece of money. We bought 600 acres of land. We started building buildings and we started a program with our own funds.
I don't have strong memories of ever meeting Don West, but that was his intention. That's what he meant to do, was to help people like me figure out what it meant to be a product of Appalachia.
When he was young, had traveled in Denmark and had been really impressed, and he talked about it back then, with the folk schools, and that's what he kind of had in mind. That's what he wanted to start with the Folklife Center here, was to help teach local people how to be self-sufficient.
Don would bring kids in from all over Appalachia, not just West Virginia, Eastern Kentucky. We had kids here from parts of North Carolina. I mean, these were children, young people, I should say, that came from very, very poor circumstances. And the whole idea was to get them out of the situation where they saw everyday poverty and despair.
His camp was actually teaching the untold history or the radical history of Appalachia, history of the struggle against strip mining, the history of the miners, the Underground Railroad, the Trail of Tears, and the Native Americans in Appalachia. Who talks about that? Nobody. Don did.
The Folklife Center was established in the late 60s, and there was a lot of social upheaval the whole country. And this place is a piece of that history. And so whenever the Miners for Democracy or the Black Lung Movement or striking, I remember during the Pittston strike, he had fundraisers for the Pittston strikers. Always, this place was open to workers and to poor people and to people of color. Part of its vision was that that the Folklife Center was going to be a place where all people could come in peace. So always there's been some challenges, of people who are afraid of letting people get together and talk about their problems and challenging the status quo. And the Folklife Center has always been a place where that could happen. It's always just been a place where people can get together. And the music festivals are part of that, I think.
I cannot remember. First weekend of August of 69 was Woodstock. Maybe that's what I've got it confused with. But anyway, we went to his festival and saw the possibility.
Don's festival was a lot more white than mine, but at least I felt at Don West, if you went out there, you were welcome. You know, you wasn't no token.
That was Jim Gill, David Morris, Esty Griffith, Yvonne Farley, David Stanley, Crystal Straba, and Ed Cabell talking about the Appalachian South Folklife Center and its founders, Don and Connie West. The 50th Anniversary Festival will begin on Friday, July 17th, with a symposium honoring Don and Connie at Concord University. Friday evening will feature a concert at the Folklife Center, followed by 2 full days of music, dance, crafts, and workshops on Saturday and Sunday. We're going to close this episode with a song that we heard in the first half of our show, a version of a spiritual tune recorded back in 1959 called Down by the Riverside.
Gonna lay down my burden down by the riverside, down by the riverside, down by the riverside. Gonna lay down my burden down by the riverside, study one. No, well, I ain't gonna study one no more. I
ain't gonna study one no more.
I ain't gonna study one no more. Well, I ain't gonna study one no more.
I ain't gonna study one no more.
I ain't gonna study one no more. I'm gonna tell my mother how.
Oh, and we have one more parting wish for all you out there, courtesy of Randall Marks.
I want peace, and I really want to fly.
We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from Us and Them, The Front Porch, and The Allegheny Front. Music in today's show was provided by Ben Townsend, and special thanks to the Alan Lomax Collection at the Library of Congress's American Folklife Center for Down by the Riverside, and I'm Gonna Wait Till My Change Shall Come. Those songs are courtesy of the Association of Cultural Equity. Our What's in a Name theme music is by Martika and William with Johnson Ridge Special from their album Songs of a Tradition. Our producer is Roxy Todd. Our intern is Jade Arthur Holtz. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter at InAppalachia or at Jessica Y. Lilly. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.